Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
Evening, good to be with you. Lots to do over the next few hours. If you've just joined us, in our first hour, we're going to have a look at, I suppose it was a fairly brave boast some time ago, to eradicate half of all world poverty by 2015. It may seem like a bold sort of mission, but there it is, and we're going to evaluate with a group from MICA Challenge, who are going to have a look at some of the Millennium Development Goals and how we're doing in Australia in particular, and how to go about getting Australia to do more. In about 2000 it was, the millennium, well, hence the name, Australia and many other world countries committed to a project to rid the world of half of its poverty, however you define it, by the year 2015. That's only 4 years away, less than 4 years away. And currently in Canberra, there's a bit of action going on in terms of lobbying and connection. And joining me from our Canberra studios, a group of people who were involved in an interesting project in how to relate to government. The churches as lobby groups have a very specific interest in world poverty, of course, and justice and social justice. And to begin a conversation about this and what's going on in terms of these Millennium Development Goals, particularly in concern to the churches, we have in our Canberra studio John Beckett, who's the MICA Challenge National Coordinator. Hello, John.
Hi, Noel.
Also, Gershon Nimbalka, who's the Advocacy Coordinator for Baptist World Aid. Gershon, g'day.
Hi, Noel.
Viv Benjamin from Tier Australia. Viv, hello.
G'day, Noel.
And Lulu Mitshabu from Caritas, which is another one of those groups which is involved in this whole challenge. Lulu, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Perhaps, John, I could begin with you. It's a grand promise, boasting we'll reduce world poverty by half. How realistic is that target looking?
Yeah, certainly, it is a grand target, but it's a realistic one. New 2000, the nations of the world gave themselves 15 years essentially to achieve this target, to halve extreme poverty really by the year 2015, and I guess eight goals underneath that large goal had to do with gender equality, with health issues for children and for mothers, had to do with issues of the environment, etc., etc. At the moment, how are we going? Well, it looks like from income terms, which is the first goal, we will achieve that goal. We will halve extreme poverty by the year 2015.
So it actually looks realistic. That's amazing. I mean, when you say reduce that poverty, what are we defining poverty as? What are the markers that you look at as church organisations, and how is our government looking at those markers?
Yeah, well, from a policy point of view, the marker that has been used internationally is called the extreme poverty line, essentially, which sits at the moment at $1.25 a day. That is the marker of that extreme poverty. And so it looks like we will achieve halving that figure by the year 2015. Of course, poverty is much more than that. You know, poverty is not really about statistics. It's about people. It's about pain. And there are still far too many people living with the pain and the injustice of poverty.
When we step back, your agencies and our government are going to try to measure what the results are, aren't we? How is that measure made? How do you get a sense that you can actually sit back and say, well, yes, we've reduced extreme poverty by half throughout the world?
Well, this is the great thing about the Millennium Development Goals. For all the faults, you can't measure all the aspects of poverty, certainly, but the great thing about these Millennium Development Goals is that for the first time in the history of the world, we have measurable targets against which we can measure how we're doing in reducing these particular indicators about, you know, how many children die before the age of five, how many mothers are dying in childbirth and pregnancy, how many people have access to a clean, hygienic toilet, how many people have access to clean water. These are the indicators that we've set in place which can show us whether or not we're making progress towards the target of halving extreme poverty.
Viv Benjamin, can I bring you in here? You belong to TIER.
That's correct.
We should try and just unpack, just to remind ourselves what these organisations are, the constituent organisations. I'll come back to you in a moment, John, but TIER, tell us, just remind us what that is.
Well, TIER is one of many organisations behind the MICA Challenge Coalition. So there's 70 NGOs that are Christian organisations as well as church denominations. So TIER is one of those, one of the founding members of MICA, and is a Christian aid and development organisation committed to integral mission. We work with local partners all around the world and 120 partners around the world in local Indigenous contexts addressing global poverty issues.
Now, when you said you were one of the original organisations that founded MICA Challenge, what were you setting out to do when you were part of that founding?
Well, MICA Challenge, as John has set out with the mandate of mobilising the church in particular to advocate for the Millennium Development Goals by 2015. So MICA Challenge's mission is to call our governments to account for the promises they've made under the Millennium Development Goals, and in particular to mobilise the church to use our voice for the voiceless and use our voice, hence the name Voices for Justice, which is the gathering that we're currently at in Canberra now, to use our voice for justice and to ask our governments to fulfil the promises that they've made to halve extreme poverty by 2015.
Well, now that we've done the sort of big picture stuff, MICA Challenge, 70 constituent organisations that are involved in this, if I was a politician in Parliament House right now, what would I be seeing? I mean, what's happening around that would capture my interest?
Well, over the next 2 days, on Monday and Tuesday, we will be in Parliament House with 250 local, ordinary, grassroots Australians from churches in every state and territory who've made a lot of effort and resource and time to come here to Canberra and meet with their political representatives. So we've got 80-plus MP meetings booked in already, and there will be more to come. And over the next 2 days, we'll be sitting down in offices talking about our asks of what we'd like to see the Australian government do in the next couple of years to achieve our commitments under the Millennium Development Goals.
So if I've got it right, you've managed to convince 250, I presume, young activists, are there many of them?
Of all ages. We've had from 12 to 70 years old, so right across the spectrum. We've got a youth program of people in high school, as well as people who are retired folk, as well as mothers and fathers and people of all ages and backgrounds.
Gershon, can I bring you in here? What's the process that you're all going to be involved in this 2 days? What actually happens? Do you actually end up in an MP's office arguing a case, saying this is what we'd like? Is that how it actually goes?
Yeah, that and a bit more, Noel. We have a lot of fun, I think, along the way. So there's going to be groups of us learning more and getting educated more. And I think a core part of what we do is we'll have people rolling into NPE's offices in groups, often from their electorate, and saying, look, these are the things that we are really concerned about. These are the things that we think will make a huge difference in the lives of the poor. What are you doing? What sort of action are you taking? So that's part of it. On top of that, we'll have some interesting sort of activities that we'll be engaging the MPs in. So there'll be a giant toilet on the lawns of Parliament House.
Well, there's something to notice, a giant toilet. You could tell us a little bit about what's behind that, because I do know, but I think you should tell us.
Sure thing. One of the things that we are looking at this year is the huge crisis in water sanitation and hygiene. It's just an area that's been severely underinvested in at a global scale. And the costs for that underinvestment have been absolutely staggering. You're looking at more than 2 million kids dying each year because they don't have access to things that we take for granted. Things like, as John was talking about before, clean water, just a hygienic toilet that they can use, or just the basic understanding of how important it is to do things like wash your hands. So we're saying, look, we need to see more action on this. We particularly need to see action in the area of sanitation. And we're going to be willing to do some crazy things to grab your attention about it.
So a large toilet at Parliament House is...
A large toilet on the lawns of Parliament House is part of that.
I suppose it's godly, I suppose. But can I say to you, Gershon, can I ask you, having been there...
clean and holy.
Well, having been there once myself years ago now, but I know you yourself as a younger man were... I think it would be fair enough to say a little bit radicalised by your experiences in Africa, weren't you? And this concerned sanitation. You came up against some stuff there that really turned you around.
Yeah, absolutely, Noel. I mean, I think for me, putting flesh on a lot of the stuff that I'd been reading, the statistics about poverty, God's heart for poverty, and the need to take action on it, really, really transformed my life. And that did happen in Africa. So me and a group of friends, having done some reading, having studied, just tinkered with a bit of theology, really, flew over to Tanzania and Kenya just to spend 3 weeks living and seeing what it is like to live in these sorts of situations of extreme poverty. And in terms of sanitation, I think the thing that really struck me was that one day we walked into the Mathari Valley, saw some really hopeful things there.
So this is in Kenya, next to this is part of Nairobi, Kenya. Basically. Isn't it?
Absolutely. Yep. Mathari Valley, it's part of one of the biggest slum areas in the world, is my understanding. Just inside Nairobi. So we walked into the Mathari Valley, and we saw a church there that was doing some really good work. You know, they had some really good education programs going. They had a couple of community gardens that they were trying to use to feed people.
Nice church.
They seemed to be doing some good stuff. But then we walked behind the church, and we got a really good understanding of the scale of the problem and just how disturbing and distressing it was.
From my personal experience, it starts with the smell, doesn't it, really?
Yeah. You get hit by the smell pretty quick, because sitting behind this church was the Nairobi dump. And situated all around this dump were these little shanties where you would see parents walk out of these shanties with their kids in tow, scrounging through the rubbish, looking for food. And then running through the middle of this dump was what was a river of what smelt like pure feces. It absolutely stank.
Well, there's no sewage there, of course, is there? There's no toilets.
Nothing. No toilets.
We're talking about tin sheds for the wealthy people, and that's about it. No glass in windows. We're talking about just about every waterborne disease you could imagine there for the kids to play in.
And it's all there, and it's all present. And you see those, they call them flying toilets.
These are the plastic bags, aren't they? You take your plastic shopping bag, you defecate in it, and you throw it away as far as you can.
That's it. Get it as far away from you as possible.
The flying toilet. So your toilet on Parliament Hill would be, I suppose, moderate by comparison to what's experienced.
Yeah,
in
we're not throwing bags of poo around, so I think the politicians should be thankful for that.
But it is actually shocking, though, isn't it? Because I do remember being in the Kibera slum myself and being told about these flying toilets and then actually seeing them, that it's just a way of trying to get it away from you. Yeah. But, of course, this then spreads the problem. And in some places, from what I could observe, there were some community toilets being built. But this is part of your particular focus, isn't it? Because you've done, I just released a report called Washing Away Poverty, haven't you?
Absolutely, where we really looked and drilled down to the details of just how bad this problem is. Of course, you know, as you mentioned, just getting the feces away from you doesn't mean it's out of the community. And unless you have things like effective and sanitary toilets to keep human contact away from feces, people are going to get sick, and they're going to get really sick, and their kids are going to suffer because of it.
In one sense, it's not a glamorous project, but it's a desperately essential project, I think it would be fair to say.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting that you pick up that word glamorous. Part of the problem is that it really isn't a glamorous project, and because of that, people just don't focus on it. They just don't pay attention to it. But, you know, the flip side of that is it is very much essential that we start shining a light on it and start saying, look, this is really important.
John Beckett, can I jump back to you? When you knock on a parliamentarian's door or you sit down for a chat, how are you going to advance something like you're basically a church umbrella body, aren't you? What do you actually ask for? What is the ask when you're trying to improve sanitation? What are you saying?
Yeah, a number of things that we're asking from the Australian government at the moment. I guess the headline is that we're seeking to encourage the government to continue to increase our aid budget, the amount of money that we give as a nation to these issues of poverty. At the moment, we give just 0.35%, 35 cents in every $100 that we make as a nation to these issues. At the moment, we have a bipartisan commitment, which we're very thankful for, to reach 0.5% of gross national income by 2015.
So half of 1% is what our aim is currently.
Yeah, that's right. So it's something that's very manageable, and we have the resources to do it, and the issues of poverty are such that we should be prioritising these issues in the midst of all the political noise that's out there at the moment. We're seeking to be a voice for the voiceless, as Viv said. But I guess on top of that is that we want that money to be spent as effectively as possible for poverty reduction. You know, we don't want it siphoned away to all sorts of different courses. We want it focused on reducing poverty. And so that's why we're going to be speaking about increasing the proportion of money that we give to child and maternal health programs, and particularly asking for an amount of money, $500 million a year, which is our fair share to this sanitation crisis.
So you're targeting specific projects? Are you saying we want to clean up the Mathare slum, we want to clean up the Kibera slum and put in some toilets? Is it that brass tacks, or is it more general than that you're going on?
No, these meetings that we'll have over the next couple of days are broader than that, but we work alongside government and AusAid, the Australian department that looks after this, to drill down into some of that detail about geographically where it gets directed, and also in terms of sectors, where does it get directed, just to make sure, as we said, that poverty reduction and the poorest of the poor are the focus of where we spend our dollars.
Well, I had a look through an older report, the 2005 Progress Report, a global partnership. It's actually on the Millennium Development Goals from AusAid. And it reads well, and it looks like there's actually a lot happening to be proud of in terms of Australia's contribution. But I think you're advocating more, aren't you? You're saying we should be doing more.
That's right, yeah. We are best placed, perhaps, certainly one of the best placed at the moment in a difficult economic environment globally. There's no doubt about that.
But well, global financial crisis number two, of course, yeah.
Absolutely. And the message is, you know, that does hit the hip pockets of Australians, ordinary Australians, and it causes some issues for us, some concerns, and people feel that deeply. But the poorest of the poor, the nations that have small economies and large populations, are the ones that feel this the deepest. And we are in a position to selflessly give of some of our excess, and our, you know, our debt to GNI ratio, if you want to go into detail, is the lowest of any nation in the world at the moment. We're actually very well placed to respond to this crisis, and it's a matter of life and death for the poor around the world.
Viv Benjamin, can I call on you, because I know you're a girl who grew up in Kew. Now, that's a very nice suburb. And now you're advocating with a group that has a toilet on Parliament Hill, and we're talking about some pretty grassroots stuff about improving the well-being of kids and mothers in particular. But what triggered you personally from such a lovely suburb to be involved in this?
Yeah, well, my church is in Kew. For me, I've had an interesting perspective growing up, in that I've sort of had a dual upbringing, one around the eastern suburbs of Melbourne and one in the Philippines in a rural, poor province on an island. There's 7,000 islands in the Philippines, and on one of them is a farm where all of my relatives live, and I spend as much time as I can every summer over there with family, and they live in they're subsistence farmers, so they are largely not working, but working the land to sustain themselves. And so for me growing up, I had a real perspective that the way that we live here in Australia is actually not normal.
This would be the announcement.
It's actually incredibly rare.
This would be the announcement. Are you hearing me in the queue speaker now?
Hello. Sorry.
Two, 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 two.
Hello, are you there?
Yes.
Sorry, Viv, we're just getting a cross mic there coming from somewhere. Can I just check that one more time to pick up on that one more time? So you're saying that you've actually had the experience of seeing the first world, as in developing world, I think, developed world we'd call it now, and then going to another world where these things are simply not available. How surprising is the contrast?
Well, the way we live here in Australia is the top of the top in the world, and we normalise it because it's how everyone around us lives. But the resources we have and the opportunities we have at our fingertips are incredibly rare, and the majority of the world don't live like that. And so for me, I couldn't help but growing up have a sense of responsibility and opportunity that we can use the influence and the education and the resources at our fingertips to right some of the wrongs of the way our world is set up at the moment, and right some of the inequalities that are grossly huge in their gaps in our world. And that's just me on a personal level, but that also applies to us as a nation and as a government, that we have the resources, as John was saying, we are incredibly well placed, and we can use our resources and opportunities and influence to right some of those injustices that face our world, and we can achieve real change. We are moving in the right direction. We expect to halve extreme poverty by 2015, and that's massive, and we can do more.
Well, I sort of apologise in one sense for asking both of you to share your own personal story, because I know it's not just about you or your families, but I think it's really helpful to hear that you've had a real experience of seeing and experiencing what it is that you're lobbying about to improve, if you know what I mean. And Lulu, could I bring you into the conversation here now? Lulu, Caritas Africa Program Coordinator, but you yourself were forced to flee your homeland before you became active in this area too.
Oh, yes. Was really, for me, it's all about, I can say I was there and I understand, and now I'm doing something. So I was in a country where it's the worst place to be a woman, first of all.
Democratic Republic of Congo, I think I'm right.
Exactly. I'm from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I was forced to leave my country very quickly. With my children, I had to flee. I had no time to think, no time to wait or to go back and get my documentation or anything like that. So I had to leave the country in 5 minutes. And I walked, I suffered, I seen all aspects of lacking and being vulnerable and poverty.
Well, can I ask you quite directly, because I know you were at a prayer breakfast in March not so long ago this year,
yes,
where you gave quite a significant presentation on this stuff, and we've been talking about sanitation, which is one of the major issues that is going
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
But one of the other issues, of course, is women's issues, and
exactly.
the Democratic Republic of Congo has a very particular problem, doesn't it, as actually happens in a number of African countries, and it directly affects women, doesn't it?
Exactly. I can say in the Democratic Republic of Congo at the present, water sanitation is a problem, because in one country we have about 1.7 million internally displaced people. So people move from one end to the other. Sanitation is a problem because it's not there. If there is no sanitation, people are getting sick. Children are dying. And women are prone to this because they're the one giving birth, they're the one looking after these children, and there is no health services
but
available
also,
for these people.
Can I say also there's the aspect of war and the consequences of war, which you spoke about as well.
Exactly. And that's the curse for the Democratic Republic of Congo, rich in mineral resources, but the extreme poverty, people live in extreme poverty because the people in the DRC are not benefiting from those mineral resources. But other people, like other nations in Africa and developed countries such as us here, we all benefiting from this. But the people of the DRC are paying big price, and it's about time people know what's going on in there.
So this is another aspect of lobbying which is
exactly.
about justice and distribution of wealth.
Exactly.
But likewise, we're talking about the area where rape has also been used against women as part of this whole disorganisation and part of the instability in the area.
Exactly. And that's what I say is the worst place to be a woman, because rape has been used as a weapon of war. And when you destroy the women, you destroy the whole nation. People, all this malicious group, including the government force, everyone is taking advantage. Raping a woman is destabilizing the whole community. Is having control over power, resources, and land. So when you rape a woman, you're really destroying the whole community. Women will be chased from their home, and they leave the children behind. The husband is demoralized because he's not considered as a man if a woman been raped or the wife been raped in his house. That's it for him. So he has to flee. So now the enemy take advantage of that and have control.
So in a sense, rape is used to destabilize society.
Exactly.
To upset everybody, the women, the husbands, the children, all of this. And you do, Ted, you did tell a story, I think, at the prayer breakfast of a young teenager called Judith Kimwe.
Yeah, Judith Kimwe. That's a sad story.
Are you able to tell us?
Oh, yes. I'm able to tell you about Judith. Judith was very young when she was raped in the DRC, in the war-torn zone. I'm really emotional about this, but the thing is, people need to know what's going on. Judith was only 13 years of age when she was raped, and the family was killed, and she was left alone. She was raped repeatedly by so many soldiers, and nobody cares. They left her suffer for nearly 4 months, raping her every day, and no access to anything. When Judith fell pregnant, they chased her. She was lucky, I can say. Usually they kill you. But Judith escaped and was found by a Caritas worker there, and she was taken to the hospital. And she had access to health care. The saga continued for Judith because that was not just the end. She found out she was pregnant, which she did not understand. She also a victim of HIV/AIDS, and she has no support at all. She doesn't even know where to go after she gets this care, medical care.
Whereas so, in Australia, the HIVs are available, of course.
Exactly. And they're not available for anybody. You need to have money. You need to have an income to have this. Nothing is free there. Because the government is in existence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. No health care. Everything has been destroyed. And for people like her, that's the reality we're talking about today. It's not just one person. There is thousands of women and girls that are going through the same thing.
Lulu, look, thank you for telling us, at least giving us some sense of the experience of women in that particular area. But John Beckett, that indicates just how broad the issues are that your coalition is facing, doesn't it? From one hand, it's water and sanitation. To the other, it's security for women, it's health. It's many, many things, isn't it?
It does, and it's that's one human story that you could multiply many, many times, which brings home to us the extreme nature of the problem that we face. And we don't claim to have all the answers. Certainly, we're trying to do our little bit, and I guess our encouragement is just to all people listening tonight and to all Australians to add your voice. I mean, people just shouldn't live in those kind of situations. Mm. We have some capacity to influence those situations from where we
exactly.
sit. And as we hear that story, as we feel the pain of it, we need to respond. And we do that individually. And we also do that collectively, because as a nation, we have some resources that can be targeted into some of these issues to help build capacity for rule of law, to help build capacity to reduce corruption in these areas, to provide health care to people like Judith, and then to seek to provide them with some aftercare when they've been through traumatic experiences like that. So it's a multifaceted problem, and it's real people that we're seeking to help here.
Well, at the grassroots level, though, you've involved, I mean, you and Gershon and Viv and Lulu and a whole lot of other people are actually training people, aren't you? The next 2 days are going to be full of action. What are you actually teaching these people to do?
Three things. I mean, we're a Christian campaign, as we've said, so we're looking at, you know, what does the God of justice, a God who created the world without that kind of injustice? What does he require of us? And, you know, we're based on a verse from Micah, the prophet, 8th century prophet, BC, who said, you know, what does God require of you but to live in a way that oozes with justice and mercy and humility? So we've been talking about that, but we've also been talking about policy, understanding what's happening for the poor around the world, understanding what good development looks like. It's not us coming in with power and doing things, it's about the poor being empowered to change their own lives and their own communities. And then we've been talking about the political process. We live here in a democracy where we have the right to raise our voices for ourselves, but it's a really powerful thing for people to go into a politician's office and have a selfless voice to raise their voice on behalf of someone else whose voice isn't heard in this context. And so they're the things we've been doing over the last couple of days.
You're on ABC Local Radio around Australia and on your pod. The number here is 1300 800 222. If you've got a question or a comment for any of our panel who are from the umbrella group Marker Challenge, who are currently in Canberra to lobby politicians on the issue of our contribution to the Millennium Goals, reducing world poverty by, well, to half of the previous level by 2015. You may have a question or a comment. My guests in our Canberra studio, John Beckett, who's the National Coordinator from Micah Challenge, Gershon Nimbalker, who's the Advocacy Coordinator for Baptist World Aid Australia, Viv Benjamin, who's the National Advocacy Coordinator for TIA, and Lulu Michabu, who's the Africa Program Coordinator for Caritas Australia, a wide range of groups from different Christian denominations. Gershon, can I come back to you? Because something I hear around the traps people get worried about is about corruption. And John just mentioned it, and Lulu has mentioned lawlessness, in fact. You've personally, I think, Gershon, see how chaotic Africa can be. How do you reassure people that money's going to get through, that you know, aid is going to be used effectively, that it's not going to be siphoned off?
Yeah, I mean, it is a big problem. I think it's a problem that a lot of people are concerned about when they start hearing about, you know, their tax dollars are being spent overseas. One of the, I think, most reassuring things I can say or I can reflect on is that AusAid are pretty savvy. The government department that delivers our aid dollars, they're pretty savvy in the way they do it. They have one of the best corruption protection mechanisms in the world, as rated by the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. And they only lose something like 17 cents out of every $1,000 they spend in corruption. I mean, that's a huge win for them. They're dealing in fairly corrupt and unstable environments at times, but to keep their levels down that low is very significant. And it's far less than things like how much corruption you would see in Centrelink or even Medicare, you know. So as a department, in terms of delivering money, they do a good job while minimizing corruption. And the other thing I guess I would add to that is that when you look at developing countries around the world, and you compare that to the Australian experience or the developed country experience, most of them are far less corrupt than what we were at a similar stage of development. So often the money that we're pouring into these countries and helping them to develop themselves is helping them to become less corrupt. That's one of the beauties of development. It's an upward spiral.
I mean governance issues as well is what you're talking about.
Absolutely. So, I mean, and I'm not even saying you have to pour in the money directly into governance issues. Sometimes it's a situation where once people's bellies start filling up, they start having the headspace to start thinking about, what is my government doing? I need to start calling them to account to make sure they're providing for our needs. So you do see that sort of transition in many, many countries, that as they develop, they start holding their government to account even more. So, yeah, I think, to be honest, the answer to corruption for me is that we need to be spending more money on development, not less.
Let's just take a call, because we've got here Mark in Gladesville. Can you hear me, Mark? Yes, Mark. What would you like to say?
Oh, well, I'm very interested in your conversation, actually. It's a very interesting discussion, and I really feel very sad about the woman that you had from the Congo. And before I move on to my point, I really find that every time a country is described as a democratic republic of somewhere, it normally means the absolute opposite of that. And the notion of kind of of giving people money to be less corrupt seems a bit like giving an alcoholic booze to be less of a whiner or something. But I can't help but wondering why, and I was listening to a conversation earlier on another station, which I mentioned about the boat people issue, which was people coming from places like Palestine, Algeria and Iraq and so forth to Australia, and why was it Australia's problem? Why is poverty in Africa, and I'm not being hard-hearted about this, but where is the leadership coming from Africa in places like the Congo, in Zimbabwe, and some of these other countries we're seeing in the Sudan and Somalia? There seems to be a complete lack of any leadership or any grasp from the leaders in Africa to actually deal with these problems, and I can't help feel that it's a little bit of a kind of reverse racism, that they don't want to deal with their own people. Why aren't countries like South Africa, which are relatively prosperous, why aren't some of the other countries in Africa dealing with these issues? Why does it have to come down always to countries like Australia? Can your man on the phone answer that?
Well, that's a big set of questions there, Mark. There'll be several ways to answer that, but can I start first, Lulu? I know that you're not a government specialist or a politician in one sense, but Caritas is a complicated organisation and has chapters all over the world, and I suspect you could probably tell us at least part of an answer to Mark's question there.
Yes, I will try to answer as best as I can. First of all, Mark, thank you for really sympathize with us, with my story. But also, I want you to understand that Africa, if you know the history of Africa, you'd not be asking that question. Let me tell you why. Africa went through colonialism, slavery, and all this is only recently Africa is coming up. It takes a long time to build up. South Africa itself, you're referring to, they just came back from all of this racism, discrimination, apartheid, as you can call it. But they're still dealing with the issue in South Africa. Mm. People in the Congo, I'll give you an example where I have expertise. From 1885 to 1905, Congo was a private property for the King of Belgium. And from 1905 up to 1960s, until the independence, we were under colonialism. So this was telling us what to do, and that we were not able to get to educate our children, our people there. The day they left, we had one graduate person in the Congo in music. And then from 1965 to 1997, we were under dictatorship with Mobutu. And there is another way where Mobutu just helped himself. And the people still remain in extreme poverty. And it's just recently where people are coming up, and in that time, it's not sufficient enough to say, yes, we can do this. We're still dealing with the past.
Mm. Lulu, I think that's really helpful to point out that many of these are newly free and not always democratic places with a history of colonialism. And I think that's a point well delivered. But John, could I ask you also, I think Mark's main point, and Mark, I apologise, I cut you off accidentally then, but John, can I ask you, his point was, why should Australia take responsibility? And I think this goes to the heart of what you want to argue, doesn't it?
Yeah, look, it does. And it's, as you said, there's a number of facets to that question, but essentially, we are not for a second saying that it's our responsibility to look after the nations of Africa. No, no. We're simply saying that we have some resources here, we have some capacity, and this is a massive issue, and we can contribute. Now, we need to do that in intelligent ways, and we need to try and ensure that those dollars are spent as effectively as possible, getting to the people on the field that need them. But when there are people who are dying daily from things that we know that we can prevent and solve, simple things like diarrhea, like giving people vaccinations, like helping kids get education and know how to wash their hands, when we have some capacity to contribute where there's a financing gap in the development cycle, then we should be doing that because that makes a difference in these people's lives.
It's the should that I'd like to go to there because, for example, Viv, I know you've been involved in, Make Poverty History campaign that somebody else you've worked with, which is sort of like the secular version of Micah Challenge, isn't it, really?
Yeah, that's right. Sister campaign.
Yep, it's the sister campaign, and you've been involved in that on the secular side. But Gershon, I know in preparing for this interview, I said to you, you know, how much is religion key to this for you? And how does religion influence what it is that Micah challenges Micah challenges response to the question Mark asked, why should Australia do something?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I guess I'll speak personally first. Like, I think for me, my moral compulsion to stand alongside and be with the poor is something that resonates deeply with my commitment to my faith. You know, I see the acts of Jesus and where he devoted his time and where he called his followers to do the same. So for me, there's an absolutely strong moral conviction that this needs to be done. You know, we need to care for do our part in caring for the 8 million kids in the world that are dying needlessly each year. I mean, to walk away from that would almost make a mockery of my faith, I feel. And I think, sorry.
No, I suppose I was breathing, thinking it so happened that one of the readings that was in the lectionary this morning connected to the whole justice issue of, that Micah theme of what does the Lord require? You know, to act justly, to love tenderly. And it talks about the practical giving. And this is something which is an imperative embedded not only in the Hebrew scriptures, but also the Christian scriptures, that you can't talk about loving God unless you actually do something for
Absolutely.
Your fellow person. That's the point, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that is the very conviction that Micah seeks to act out of.
Yeah, and I think... Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was just going to say, Noel, as well, we challenge the notion that we can draw our own predetermined limits around who our neighbour is. You know, Jesus, in response to a question from one of the teachers of the law when he lived as to who is your neighbour, he essentially told the story of the Good Samaritan. Not many people know that that story comes...
Who's the foreigner? Response the to outsider. Yeah. The outsider.
And so we're saying that these people, you know, we believe are made in the image of God and therefore have inherent dignity. And so when that dignity is in question, as it is with the injustice of poverty, we need to respond because we can't put limits around who we say our neighbour is.
As just a good Christian, we have a responsibility to respond. Mm. And a good citizen of this world, when we see our neighbour dying, we're not going to say yes. It's not our responsibility because they're too far or anything. We have that commitment. We have that moral responsibility to respond when we see our neighbour suffering to that extent.
And I'd also add that as well as the huge moral responsibility and motivation that we all share here, what we're doing here at Micah Challenge is actually just holding our own government to account for promises they have already made. So we're not asking anything from them than to fulfil the promise that they have already made and repeated again and again to meet Australia's fair share to the Millennium Development Goals.
Well, this is the point of the project, though, is that Micah Challenge is actually sort of, I suppose, what Jonathan Swift in Gulliver's Travels, he has that image of the flapper, the guy with a bladder on a stick that flops it in the parliamentarian's face to remind them of what's happening. And in a sense, Micah Challenge is about reminding, persuading, saying, look, you promised this. This is what our targets are. And in a sense,
Absolutely.
That's what you're down there being. You in a sense, not being annoying, but what you're doing is you're calling to account. That's what the project's about. Am I right in that understanding?
Yeah, Kevin Rudd last year, you know, speaking to our key event, referred to us as nagging prophets.
There you go.
So that's Well, it's a nice way. We don't mind being described like that. We seek to bring a message that is gracious but that is strong at the same time, because we're trying to speak truth to power, I guess.
I wouldn't think you were being very good if you were training lobbyists to go and alienate politicians. I don't know that that's the way it actually goes, is it?
No, that's right.
We do have another call, Jeanette. Jeanette, you wanted to ask a question of Lulu, I think.
Yes, hello. I always catch the tail end of these things. I'm sorry, about the story of the young girl.
About Judith.
Judith, yeah. I'm trying to hold back the tears, sorry, hearing the story. I have heard these stories about the Congo before. I'm just wondering, because how she is, if she had the baby, if she's okay?
Yeah, she had the baby. I probably have to say that through the program that we run in Goma, Judith was able to get medical help, and she was able to get counseling, and she's now able to sew because she was given some skills, and she's earning an income at a younger age, and she's looking after her baby.
Oh,
and she just accepting that baby is also a problem, but she was able to accept that baby and look after her. So that's really a good story to tell, but it's also sad at the same time.
I know, as I said, I've heard stories before, and I suppose this is a silly thing to ask, but does anyone ever get charged or found out, you know, that...
Oh, yes. Yes, there is program available there just to help women to persecute the perpetrator of this crime. As we talk about corruption, the justice system is corrupt. But just doing that, the fact that we have somebody saying to these women, yes, we will help you and take your case to court, even though the person will be released after 3 months, but at least their life is telling the women that your life matter. Somebody care. And that's important.
Jeanette, thank you very much for your call. It was good to hear the end of that story. Thank you.
That's all right. Thank you.
Thank you. And Lulu, thank you for letting us know that there actually was at least a partially happy ending there, that it wasn't just all bad news that we were hearing. But I suppose that question also that Jeanette asks points out that these local partnerships that you've mentioned, John, that you've mentioned, Lulu, which means these organizations are working with people on the ground in Africa who are also running programs themselves. It's not just, you know, big vans moving in with developed world people to do things, is it, John?
No, not at all. So I'd say, you know, you look at all the partners that make up Mica Challenge at the moment, and they're certainly always improving the way they do development, but very much have a focus now on working with locals, training locals, giving some expertise, but empowering local communities to own the projects for themselves so that they can be sustainable long into the future.
Well, we're out of time, I'm sorry. We have only covered part of what we were going to talk about, but I want to thank our panel. That's John Beckett, who's the Mica Challenge National Coordinator, who's down there leading, I suppose, the door knocking and leading the lobbying towards our politicians who, I suppose, have influence when it comes to implementing our policy on foreign aid. I want to thank Viv Benjamin, who's down there also mixing it up, National Advocacy Coordinator for Tier Australia. Gershon Nimbalka, the Advocacy Coordinator for Baptist World Aid Australia. And Lulu Michabu, the Africa Program Coordinator from Caritas Australia. I hope your lobbying is successful.
Thanks, Thank Noel. Great Thanks, to talk Tom. To you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.